Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Bien, nous allons passer au séminaire de cette année. C'est la sixième conférence de ce cycle consacré au sommeil, au replay et à l'apprentissage. And I'll switch to English to introduce today's speaker is going to speak in English. He's coming from Oxford. This is Professor Tim Berends, one of the world's greatest specialists of computational neuroscience, certainly. A growing field where we try to model finally, precisely, the steps that are occurring in a computation, and in particular in the computation of learning abstract structures. I think this is going to be the topic of today's talk, and in particular, the role that replay, even outside of sleep, perhaps during rest, may play in building deeper, more structured representations in the brain. And Tim has been a specialist of this field for many years. Now he's been working a lot on learning and the statistical aspects of learning, the Bayesian aspects of learning, the notions of uncertainty and volatility and related concepts. Tim is a fellow of the Royal Society. And he is the deputy director of the Wellcome Center for Integrative Neuroscience, which is a massive research center in the UK. And he's also recently the chief editor of eLife.
Yes.
I think it's important to say that because it's a transformative model of scientific publishing. We all lose extraordinary amounts of time with the publishing process, and some aspects of it are very good. We get feedback from our colleagues, but some aspects of it are, I think, very blocking, including the money that we spent on this process and the slowness of it. So Tim is trying to change it all through eLife, and we, in the lab at least, we submit a lot of papers to eLife. Right. I think it's a good idea. We really like the model. So without further ado, Tim, on building models of the world in replay. Thank you so much, Tim.
Je suis désolé de pas parler en français. Can you hear me okay? Yes? Great. I have not quite reached the age where I have to give all of my talks sitting down. And I realize Stan has. But I might pop up and down during the talk. I'm sort of nearly 50, so I'm nearly getting there. Good. I'm going to talk about how we build models of the world inside our brains. Just a couple of slides on some history. Back in the 1940s and 50s, there was a big debate in psychology between the East and West Coast of America about what controls our behavior. This is a guy called Skinner, B.F. Skinner, who used to argue that effectively all of our behavior is controlled through reward and punishment. And you can get increasingly sophisticated behaviors by stitching together behaviors that predict reward at increasingly long distances. This is called conditioning. And he would say things like, the real problem is not whether machines think, but whether men do. And give me a child and I'll shape him into anything. Shaping is this process of stitching together rewards into sophisticated, reward predicting behaviors into increasing complexity. He had quite a lot of influence over the US educational system in the 60s and 70s, and there were whole educational programs designed around these rather pernicious ideas. At the same time, on the West Coast of America, there was a guy called Edward Tolman who was making almost the exact opposite argument in psychology. He was studying rats in mazes, and he would make observations like, I can leave the rat in the maze with no reward at all, no food at all, and they'll learn lots of things about the structure of the maze, such that later, when I put some rewards in there, they'll find them much faster than if they hadn't been running around the maze beforehand. He would do things like block arms of the maze and see if the mouse, having never taken a particular route to reward, could immediately find shortcuts. Those are the kinds of experiments that he would do. And the results in his mind of those experiments were that the thing controlling behavior was not just stitching together behaviors that control reward, that predict a reward, but rather an entire map of all of the experiences that you would have to date. So some model, internal model of the world. So he'd say things like, we assert that the central office itself is far more like a map control room than it is like an old-fashioned telephone exchange. That's his metaphor for stitching together, linking together things that predict reward. Obviously, like all debates in the history of science, both of them are right to some extent or the other. Both of these processes exist in the brain. But this knowledge structure process is a very interesting one and certainly has an increasing reliance as you get higher up the evolutionary chain towards primates and humans. Okay, so I think really what I'm going to talk about today is what does this map look like inside your brain and how do you build it? Big topics. And I'll try to address some of those, some parts of that topic, by no means all of it. Okay, if you're interested in how you would build a model of the world, the critical thing that makes it a model of the world is that you understand the relationships between different things. You understand how to get from here to here on a maze. You understand all of the relationships between, for example, the Collège de France and Neurospin and my center in the UK, all the things that make them similar and different. If you understand those relationships, then you can stitch together your experience into a model. And so I guess when I started thinking about this 10, 15 years ago, I wondered, I thought this was the key part of the problem. How do I build and represent these links between different events and objects in the world? And if you're thinking about how to build or represent a link inside your brain, then there are several kinds of options that you can think about. So for example, think about this link that presumably exists in all of our brains between the Starbucks fairy and the cup of coffee. One is associated with the other. One thing you could do if you wanted to link those things together is to take the neurons that fire when you see the Starbucks fairy and the neurons that fire when you have a cup of coffee, and you could build new synapses between them such that one always ends up activating the other. That's one thing you can do. Indeed, we know that there are parts of the brain where this kind of associative reasoning happens. But another thing that you could do is have separate pools of neurons that represent the actual relationships themselves. That might seem like a difficult thing to imagine right now, but I'll show you some in a minute. Some neurons that understand the structure of relationships. The immediately profitable thing about doing that is that if there's some similarity between one set of relationships and another, for example, I could change the association to this Nike whoosh and this shoe, then those same neurons could do an inference or a generalization. They can use the knowledge that they acquired in understanding the relationship between the Starbucks fairy and the coffee and say, okay, great, I can buy the shoe wherever I see the Nike whoosh. That's an inference, a generalization, and it can only happen if you represent the relationships explicitly in neurons rather than in synapses. Okay. How do these, so there's some kind of structural knowledge that we're looking for represented in some neurons, I guess. How do these kinds of things allow inferences? Well, throughout this talk, I'm going to be moving between rodents and primates. There'll be some data from each in the talk. And so let's just think about the simplest kind of inference that you might imagine that, in, that Tolman was talking about in his rats. And so here's a rat that has found some cheese by taking this rather tortuous red path. Actually, probably more like a mouse. The question that's interesting to Tolman, to me, is what happens when I want some cheese again? Do I just take this rather tortuous red path again, like Skinner would have said, which is I'm going to reinforce the actual actions that led to the rewards, or can I do something else? If I understand how space works, I understand that we're living on a two-dimensional world, effectively, a two-dimensional manifold. If I understand that, then I can find a different route to make a shortcut to this reward. So that's only possible if you have some understanding of how space works, and it's possible because space is a very regular thing. It follows a known structure that's always the same. But in our world, there are lots of known structures that repeat in similar ways. Here's just a few of them, taken from some work by Josh Tenenbaum. There's hierarchies of concepts, like the hierarchy of all animal species, you can see in the top left. There's linear-like structures, like political affiliations of judges in the US Supreme Court, which will be the similar, which will follow the same kind of structure as like the linear structure of some racetracks or the linear structure of maybe your relationships in the chain of your office. There's hierarchies of sequences. Our life is structured according to days, weeks, months, years that live in a hierarchy, a strict factorial hierarchy. And then there's increasing combinations of these types of structures which can be built together into really quite complicated things. This is a photograph I took here. I don't know if you can see my mouse. Yeah, of my my son organizing his toy cars when he was 2 years old. And you can see he's organized them in an extremely complicated hierarchy involving which film that they were involved in, what their functional role is. But that's not a random line of cars. That's a line of cars in a two-year-old's brain that's been structured according to a very dense set of structural knowledge. My favorite example of an extreme version of inference that humans are capable of doing because they understand structure of the structure of the world comes from movies, and this is a particularly extreme version in Quentin Tarantino movies. Here is a movie called Kill Bill, which comes in various chapters, which tell a strict story of various protagonists throughout the film. But the order that you're presented with these chapters is actually like this, the totally different order from the order in which you need to put the story together to understand what's going on. The only reason you can do this is because you understand the possible causal chain of events in your mind that makes a coherent narrative or a coherent structure. And so whilst you're watching the movie, you have to do inference over which order the scenes came in the actual story of the protagonist's life. It's a very easy thing for humans to do, or at least if they're concentrating, it's a very easy thing for humans to do, but it seems like an extraordinary thing that we can do it's certainly something that in order to do so, you need to have all sorts of background structural knowledge to be able to do that kind of inference. Okay. So how does it work? Let's go back to the simple thing that I was talking about before, which is the simplest form of inference I think that we know that animals do, which is spatial relationships. And so here is, on the left, is an animal, a rat or a mouse, running around a box. And here are two types of cells that you can record in their brain. One is a place cell, which fires whenever the animal goes to the right-hand side of the box here, and there are other place cells for every part of that box. That one tells you where the animal is right now. But this one on the right-hand side here, this grid cell, is doing something different. It's firing at a regular pattern of hexagons around the box, very much like those graph lines I showed you in the image about three or four slides ago. That's what I mean by a cell that understands the structure of the problem that you're talking about. There would be no reason to have such a cell if you were not optimized for running around a two-dimensional plane. The only reason to have that cell being regularly firing on a two-dimensional plane is because of the structure of the problem you're trying to solve right now, which is spatial navigation. So they're super cool cells. They won the Nobel Prize in 2014, all of these. And I should have put these grids up before. I hope you noticed what I was saying with the grids. So these grid cells are hexagonal instead of square for various reasons that I won't go into now, but they nevertheless form these hexagonal grids through space. Okay, so these grid cells can be found in the place cells are found in the hippocampus of a rodent and a human. The grid cells are found in the entorhinal cortex of a grid cells of a rodent, also of a human, but I'll show you as well that in other parts of the brain of a human. They come along with various other types of cell that appear to be bespoke for doing all sorts of spatial-like computations or arithmetic. The one that I want you to remember is this one here, which is an object vector cell. I'll refer back to that later. This one here, the grid cell, says basically, I'm at position x, y, a coordinate in this space. And this one here says, I'm this vector away from something interesting, like a piece of cheese, for example. So this one always fires some vector away from the interesting thing. There's a whole load of various other ones that make up the machinery of mapping space. In the human, you can also find grid cells outside of the hippocampal entorhinal system, just one synapse away, though, in other parts of this, what we call the default mode network, like the medial frontal cortex and the medial parietal cortex. Okay, so is this just a spatial, is this a unique thing for space? Or can these types of solutions be used to solve other problems? Well, we think in our lab that these are general types of solutions for many of the problems. The evidence for this is building, but it's certain that these grid cells in particular can be used for non-spatial two-dimensional problems at least. Here, are the spatial cells again, and here in non-spatial problems, you can see the same type of grid-like activity in problems that require mapping two dimensions. In this case, or that require mapping Euclidean dimensions. Actually, this one is actually only one of the two dimensions. This is a rat recorded by Dmitry Aronov, who's not running through space, but it's instead running through frequency space. There's a there is a tone playing, which is going boo, and there are place cells that code for the frequency in that thing, and there are grid cells that have little bumps as you move through that frequency space, as if you're moving through real space. And this one here comes from our lab at about the same time, which shows a smoke signal for grid cells that I'll explain next slide, something that could, I think, only come from grid cells, a signal which, but the two dimensions that it was mapping was not the physical space, but was instead the dimension of the leg length and the neck length of birds, because they were trying to do a task which involved understanding what bird they were looking at, and these birds varied according to the length of their legs and the length of their neck. Sorry, neck and legs. For the ornithologists amongst you, those are in fact the two principal dimensions of birds. Cool. Okay, so these grid cells appear to be able to map non-spatial worlds. Just for those, because I'll use it later, when we're recording grid cells in humans so far, we've had to rely on this smoke signal of humans, which relies on the fact... Sorry, am I doing something wrong?
No, perfect.
Oh, we can't see single cells in humans unless we're in an operating room. So there are some attempts to do it that way. But we can see this smoke signal, which almost certainly derives from the grid cells. The signal varies depending on which direction you're running through this space, and it varies with this six-fold symmetry because you get less signal when you're running across the fields of this hexagon than when you're running along the fields of this hexagon. It's this very precise signal, which is big whenever you're running aligned to the hexagon and small whenever you're running not aligned to the hexagon. It's a lovely little smoke signal to have because we can see grid cells now in normal humans. But it's indirect, and so I just wanted to show people who've seen this line of work and think, okay, but I wish they were recording cells. Now we are, and so here is an actual non-spatial grid cell recorded by Steve Kennelly's lab in a monkey, and there are lots of them, and it's very exciting for me because I started this thing, I guess, 12, 15 years ago, and now we can really see them. So that's cool. There are really these non-spatial grid cells, and so this architecture that may have evolved for space, or this architecture that may be a general principle that allows you to represent structural knowledge, this architecture definitely is usable outside space. Cool. So that's the two-dimensional things. We've also recently shown, again with smoke signals so far, not with individual cells, but we've also recently shown that a similar coordinate system, like a structured architecture, works for things that don't just sit on a two-dimensional manifold. Here, this is one of those sequence hierarchies that I was talking about before in that structural knowledge slide. And Anna Spector in the lab has found a way using human imaging to find indirect evidence of this kind of structure existing in the human brain as well. And so we've taken this idea of these cells that code for the structure of problems from grid cells in space, and then we've shown that they exist in other non-spatial problems in two dimensions, and then we've also shown that they exist in problems, non-spatial problems, that are not just two-dimensional. Starting to build evidence for these general structural representations of the relationships between objects in your brain. Okay. I'm half an hour in, and that's the end of some background. We're now getting into, well, maybe I started at 11:06, so maybe. But the what Stan asked me to talk about, apart from giving you some this background of structural knowledge, he asked me to talk about this amazing phenomenon, replay. You can't understand this phenomenon, replay, until you've seen all those place and grid cells, so I feel justified in telling you about that first. But if you see those place cells, then you could imagine you could record those place cells, then you would know where the animal was, right? Because those place cells, one of them fires when the animal's in one place, another one fires when the animal's in another place. And so here I'm going to read out where the animal is from those place cells. And so first, he's running along a linear track. First he's resting, and now he's moving. Now he's resting again. Now he's moving again. This is where the animal is read out from his place cells. But the amazing thing, if you look at these data carefully, is not that you can read out where the animal is. I can read out where the animal is by looking with my eyes. What's amazing is what happens here in these little tiny blips that you can barely see on this thing. These little tiny blips that exist over a few milliseconds, 200 milliseconds, 150 milliseconds, you can see that if you just expand these blips, they run down the whole path as well. This is little packets of activity that recapitulate the entire experience of the animal. And they tend to happen when the animal is resting. So I think what Stan has been talking about in this course, and what I'm going to talk about now for the rest of this talk, are these packets. What are these packets of activity doing? Are they using the structure of knowledge to do inference? Are they just consolidating memories, or are they planning? What are they doing? So just to give you one more background slide about replay. So here is an animal running down a track. The reason we can decode those things, here is an animal running down a track, and each of these colors is a different place cell firing when they're running. So when he's here, the red one fires. When he's here, the blue one fires. But later when he's resting, what you see a little sharp wave ripple, which is something you can record in the average electrical activity. And during these sharp wave ripples, you can record these cells, and these cells will play out the same sequence, so blue to red, and they'll either do it forwards like this, or they'll do it backwards like this. So you can see the red to blue in one of these ripples, these little packets. And there, this is what happens when you're sitting down, having a cup of tea, etc. Okay, so in the remainder of this talk, I'm going to show you some work which is trying to argue that this replay is not just replaying the past, but it's doing inference about possible futures. It's doing inference over the, using these structured knowledge that I've been telling you about. I'm going to try and to persuade you that it does so by aligning our experience to that structural knowledge. And it's always making these inferences in the background, making you faster at thinking when you actually need the knowledge. So it's always just organizing your mental maps, doing inferences over the unseen relationships so that you have immediate access to the knowledge when you need it. I can see from the time that I won't get to the last bit. Okay, great. So replay is not just replaying the past, it's doing inference about possible futures. In order to do this study, the first thing we tried to do was invent a way of seeing this kind of replay in humans rather than in rodents. So I'll show you some rodent data in a minute, but let's just start with some humans. And we were thinking back to that Kill Bill example, saying, well, surely what we'd like to see is when they've seen a certain number of chapters in the wrong order, we'd like to see an inference putting them in the correct order, playing out the sequences in the correct order. That would be an inference, not a replay of the past. And so we designed a laboratory experiment a bit like this, where we showed them a bunch of experiences in the wrong order, but they knew how to put them back into the right order. They had the structural prior to put them back into the right order, a little bit like the priors that you have about orders of films, but much less rich, obviously, because it's a laboratory experiment. So we jumbled the sequence up, and we taught subjects how to unjumble it, like this. And then we give them some new stimuli with the same jumble structure, but different stimuli. And then the question is, what do you see in replay? You can try and measure replay in their brain. What do you see? Do you see the jumbled sequences, which is the ones they actually saw? That would just be a memory. Or do you see the unjumbled sequences, which would require this inference based on the structure? Okay, so to measure replay in humans, we can't put electrodes in to measure the actual place cells. So we played a game like this. We put them in a magnetoencephalography scanner, which is, you may have heard about this before in Stan's lectures, I guess. Stan uses it all the time. And if you show somebody a picture whilst that you're measuring their brain scan, then you can, from the sensors on the brain scan, you can figure out which picture they're looking at. And so you can decode which picture they're looking at, but you could run that decoder not only when they're looking at it, but also later in rest and say, was there any other time when their brain was representing that stimulus when they weren't looking at it? A little bit like the rat representing that part of space when they were resting at the start or the end of the track. So that's the game we're going to play. We're going to figure out the MEG sensor pattern for many different pictures, and then we're going to show them two sequences all jumbled up in the wrong order of these pictures, and then we're going to let them rest, and we're going to see, do the sensor patterns, like the cells in the rodent hippocampus, do the sensor patterns replay those sequences? And if so, what order do they replay them? Do they replay them in the order that the people saw them, like a memory, or do they replay them in the unjumbled order, like a structured inference, like finding the shortest path in space? And just as a little teaser, here is an example of those sensor decoders playing out through time, just taking a snippet from the decoders, and you can see these stimuli are playing out 1, 2, 3, 4, all within about 100 milliseconds, the same time period as the rodent replay, and they're playing out, in this example, in the correct unjumbled sequence. But we want to know if that's statistically true across the whole across all of time and across all our subjects. And so we have to make a statistical method to figure out if this is a regular pattern in the resting replay. And it turns out it is. You can see that from this graph. I'm not going to explain how we made this graph, but I'm just going to show you a few features of it because you'll need them in a later study I'm going to talk about. This graph shows you that there's replay here because it goes above this dotted line, which is a statistical, which is the sort of threshold for telling you whether there's replay. It tells you the replay is really quick. This is the lag between different stimuli. It's about 40 or 50 milliseconds. And it says, I first play out one stimulus, then the next stimulus, then the next stimulus, and the gap between those stimuli is about 40 milliseconds. This says the replay goes forwards because it's going up. Don't worry too much about that because there are other situations where it goes backwards. Critically, in order to find this out, we had to label A, B, C, D as the unjumbled sequences, not the jumbled ones. So this means the replay has done the inference correctly. If you try with the jumbled ones, you see nothing, you see no effect at all, way below the statistical threshold. So what's happening in this rest period after we show subjects the jumbled up sequences? So we show them something like CB, AB, BC, and their brain in this rest period is going ABCD, 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 with like 40 milliseconds between them in these little packets. The little packets being played out, doing an inference over what's happened. So this is a bit like watching a movie like this, where you first see where you see somebody preparing a cup of coffee in totally the wrong order. They pour the coffee before it's made, and then they put it in the cup in the wrong place. But then your little replay packets in the middle of this will play out the correct order in these little replay packets down here whenever you get a pause. And in fact, although the study that I showed you was from a much simplified example in laboratory conditions, actually Avital Hahami has done the same thing actually while people are watching movies. And you, what happens is you get loads of these replay packets whenever the movie pauses at a scene boundary, doing all sorts of reorganization. So I guess the take-home message for you guys is to pause regularly when you're trying to explain something, to give the opportunity for lots of replay packets to be reorganized in your other people's brains. Okay, so the next part of the talk is going to go back into rodents, and it's going to ask something like, how do these inferences actually happen at the cellular level? So we're going to conclude by saying what's happening is that the current experiences are effectively being aligned to the coordinate systems that already exist in the brain, the structural knowledge. And so let's go back to this very simple example. We're going back to space and back to rodents, and we're going to try and make a much more detailed mechanistic argument. Okay, this bit is by Jacob Bakermans and James Whittington. So how did the animal find the correct path to that cheese? The argument that we're going to make here is they didn't do it when they were looking for the cheese. They did it at the moment they found the cheese at the first time. When they found that cheese, what they're going to do is they're going to send loads of these little replay packages out, building up a map everywhere else in the environment with like directions to the cheese. And so everywhere now has a cell which says, if I'm here, the cheese is over there. And so when they later want the cheese again, now they've got that vector sat there. You can only do that if you've got a coordinate system, because you have to bind that vector to a particular part of space. Okay, so this is what we want to do. When you find the cheese, instead of just remembering a location for the cheese and planning to get to it later, what's going to happen is these replays are going to build an entire map to get to that cheese. So the easiest and simplest way of doing this with neurons is to take one of these coordinate neurons, like a grid cell, which knows where you are in space, and bind to it the other neuron that I told you about in that first slide that we know exists in the entorhinal system, which is a cheese over there neuron. So there are these other neurons, these object vector neurons, which allow you to do this, to say, I'm going to find, I'm always going to fire when I'm 2 to the southwest of a goal, or 2 to the southwest of an object. Another neuron would be 1 to the northeast. It codes a vector between me and the thing that I'm looking at, the thing I'm interested in. So what you'd like to do is, when you find the cheese, you'd like to send replays throughout the whole map, and you'd like them, those replays, to bind together the correct coordinate with the correct vector, such that next time I'm over here, I already know what the vector is to get to where I want to go. And it seems that's what's going to happen in this. That's what's happening in your brain. I'm just going to show you a bit of evidence for that right now. So we need a task where rats actually do this kind of behavior. Here's one of those. It's a task with lots of possible food wells for the rat, but one of them is repeatedly rewarded and the other ones are only randomly rewarded. And so what the rat does this is it goes in the morning and it tries to find which one of these home wells is the home, which one of these wells is the home where it's going to be repeatedly rewarded that day. It finds it. And then it knows the next trial will be at somewhere else, somewhere totally random. So now it has to look in all of the little ports. But then it knows it's going to have to return straight to the first one that it found, which is the home well. And then it goes and finds a random one again, and then it goes back to the home well again. And so to do this task, the animal has to know how to get to that home well from anywhere in space, not from the place where it's experienced that home well, right? And so to do that, it has to solve that inference problem I was talking about before. There's data on this. We didn't have to record this one. We do rodent experiments in our lab, but this comes from David Foster's lab. The data already exists, and so we wanted to have a look what was happening in the replays when they found that home well. Are they making out a map and making new place fields, telling them where to go to get back to the cheese? So what's happening in those replays? Well, I can show you something interesting. This is a cell. This is its place field here before it saw a replay, before it found the home well. And then when it found the home well, here is a replay that happened. Here are all the other cells. And then this neuron is now spiking here, which is at a different place from its place field. So now this cell has now got a spike, not at its place field, but somewhere else over here in the world. But now if I look at its new place field for the whole of the rest of that day, its new map looks like this, and it has a new place field here, the same place that it spiked in this replay. And so this replay has built a new place field in this neuron. And we can quantify that by showing the change map here between this after the ripple and before the ripple. And we can see it's big and red here, which means after the ripple, there's much more firing here. And the X is the location of where it fired during the ripple. Yep, so this ripple has fired and built a new place field. So this is something that's happening when the animal is sitting there eating the food, chilling, drinking a cup of tea at the home well. Something's happening that's building a new place field somewhere else in the world. We're assuming that it's saying, the cheese is over there, or the cup of tea is over there. We can do more than just assume, though. I'll show you in a second. Here's another example, same thing. Before the replay, the place field's up here. There's a change, so the ripple happens down here, which is not quite in the place field. And after the replay, the place field moves to down here. Here's another example. So again, it's got a new place field at the same place it replayed. We can actually look at this across the whole population of cells, every ripple, every cell recorded, and we can take this change map and center it on X, and you can take a circle around it and say, what was there this change? Can I average these red bits up? And the answer is, yeah, across the whole population, in all the cells, you get new place fields at the place where they rippled. The cool thing is that that's only for replays that happen at the home location when they have to make these new maps. Okay, so it looks like we're making new place fields. We're changing our map somehow in these replays, but how? To answer that, we can look at what happens if the cheese moves. I'm just looking at the time, but I'm okay, I think. We can look at what happens if the cheese moves, and we can ask, is the cell moving from the same vector from the old cheese to the same vector to the new cheese? Is it a pointing at cheese place field, effectively? So this is what we want to say. We want to unlink this cheese neuron from the old coordinate, and we want to put it onto the new coordinate, like this. So this is what's happening in cells. I'm just going to quickly go through this. I'm What's happening is a new place field happens at the, some coordinate from the new home. A place field is deleted at the same coordinate from yesterday's home well. So we've got an added place field and a deleted place field, and they're both added and deleted by replay. So the replay is taking the neuron that says cheese over here, and it's moving it to say cheese is over there now, right? And so that's what the replay is doing, and it's doing this throughout the whole map. It's just going around the whole map, organizing your representations to point you towards the cheese, doing this inference in rest, not at the time when you're going to need it, but when you need it, but doing it way before you need it so that it's much quicker when you need it. I'm going to skip this next slide. What this next slide says, without understanding the details, is that these neurons that are these vector cells, they are particularly overrepresented in these replays, as if what those little ripples are doing is they're shifting around the map, particularly those neurons that are saying, move the cheese around. Great. Just onto the last bit of this talk in the last 10 minutes, I'm going to go back to humans, and I'm going to try to persuade you. So what's happening from that previous part is that when you find something, ripples, these little packets of activity, go around making pointers to that thing so that you can use them again later. I'm now going to show that this is always happening. It's happening in much more complex tasks than spatial inferences, and it's using these coordinate systems I was telling you about before. This is work, this is work by Yakin Yu and Yunze Liu, in order to demonstrate this, they did this. They've got this cool task that uses these cards. I don't know if you or your kids have ever played these games where characters have an attack and a defense and maybe all sorts of other properties. But you win a round of cards if you attack somebody and your attack is bigger than their defense, or if you're the defender, you win if your defense is bigger than their attack. And so you can see that this, like spatial navigation, is a two-dimensional problem, which you can build a map of. And Yakin and Yunze have developed this task in such a way that the subjects have to remember where all of the cards are on this map, because they don't see the attack and defense as labeled on the cards. They just have to remember each one's attack and defense. And then the question is, what's happening when the subjects are doing this task? And how did they build this map? Is it through these replay mechanisms? And so I'm just going to show you to start with what's happening to those replays during the task. So here are all of the cards on this 2D map. And the question is, okay, when I say put this attack one against this defense one, does the subject have to replay out all the ones in the middle to try and find out which one's going to win? This one beats this one, this one beats this one, this one beats this one. Okay, so this one's going to beat this one. That kind of argument. And the answer is yes, and it looks very much like the figure I showed you before for the movie watching inference, except it's got one difference. So you can see this same replay I showed you before, this 50 millisecond fast replay, but now there's this other peak that has a much slower replay at 150 milliseconds as well. This slow replay is much more at the speed of thinking. 40 milliseconds is way too fast to be thinking, but 150 milliseconds is getting into the speed of conscious thought. So a few little facts about these two different types of replay. The first is that the more of the fast replay you have, the better you are at the task. The more of the slow replay you are, the worse you are at the task. And so if you have this slow replay, it seems like it means you have to think. You don't just know the answer to which ones are going to win and which one's going to lose. And that, when you have to think, you end up doing it worse than knowing. The next thing to tell you is that the fast replay is in all the areas that we care about in the brain, the medial temporal lobe, where the hippocampus and entorhinal cortex is. And this slow replay seems to come more from the frontal cortex, where the thinking happens, in simple terms. And I forget the bottom half of this. That was supposed to come up later. So I guess many of you are thinking in this task, well, why do they have to do that sequencing at all? Why do they have to work out which was beating which was beating which? If they have the coordinate system, if you know that 5 is bigger than 3, if you know that 8 is bigger than 7, you don't have to do the thinking. If you've got the map worked out well, if you know where they are on the map, you can just solve the problem without any thinking. And indeed you can, if Yunze and Yekin go and look for this for the same smoke signal that I told you for grid cells before, they find strong evidence of this grid-like signal again now in this card-like task, again mapping the coordinates of this non-spatial task. And the fun thing is, the more of these grid cell, the more of the fast replays you have, the more you're using this coordinate system, the structured knowledge, and the more of this, and the less of the slow replays you have. So you have to actually do the thinking, build the sequences. So so the argument from here is that this, having these replays, building this map like the rats were doing before, is preventing you from having to do this rapid thinking online. Two last data points before I'm going to end. This study by Yunze and Yekin is an epic thing. Is an epic thing. They had subjects in the MEG scanner for 10 hours. And so they recorded all sorts of things, including the original learning and many periods of background resting activity. But when they taught them the learning, they only taught them one dimension at a time. They'd say, look, this card is better on attack than this card. This card is better on attack than this card. This one's better on defense than this card. They'd never show them the actual thing, the actual two-dimensional map that they needed to do for the inference. The question is, like in the movie watching, in rest, did the replay still stay with the experienced one-dimensional directions, or like in the rat and the movie watching, did it fill out the whole map? Did it replay in the two continuous dimensions? And the answer is yes. It replays in the two-dimensional, in the full two dimensions during rest, when there's no inferences going on in the behavior. They're just sitting there. The brain in the background is sending these little packets, filling out the map, building in the two-dimensional replay. So this rapid replay is building the map offline. If you do that offline, then later online, you have more grid cell activity and you're better at the task. So you, all the time when you're just sitting around having a cup of tea, what you should be doing, what your brain is doing, is filling in all the experiences that you've had that day and making them all match up with each other, So that you when you get asked a question later, you know the answer already. You don't have to think about it there and then. So get lots of rest and have lots of cups of tea. I'm just going to end on this one final point, which is that all these structural signals, these replay and structural signals, they develop in the school time, in the age of school, from 8 to 18. And they predict measures, real-world measures like IQ. They predict real-world measures like IQ much better than things like age do. And so that's just a final piece of evidence to say, take that Skinner. Don't Don't make your educational programs about reward and punishment. Make them about developing rich structural knowledge. I'm going to end right there.
Cool. Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.